Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. And I'm here to bring you another exciting episode. Today, we have something very interesting and very different. I have this amazing clinician I met actually through Ishwish, and she is amazing. She's in the New York area, Dr. Tanya Dempsey. We had a great discussion today. We had a great discussion around something called mast cell activation syndrome, which some of you may be listening and may have it, and other of you may have never heard of it. So you guys will get the inside scoop today, because as someone who treats a lot of sexual dysfunction and hormonal things, you know, I see it a lot. And so Dr. Tanya Dempsey is a world-renowned expert in complex multi-system diseases and founder of the AIM Center for Personalized Medicine in Purchase, New York. She uses functional and integrative medicine to get to the patient's root cause of illness and help them to find a path toward optimal health. Her extensive knowledge and experience with mast cell activation syndrome, mold, and Lyme disease, as well as other vector-borne diseases, has propelled her to the forefront of the medical community as a recognized and trusted speaker, researcher, advocate, and physician. She is board certified in internal medicine and integrative and holistic medicine. She received her MD from Johns Hopkins and her BS degree from Cornell, and she completed her internal medicine at NYU Medical Center. She recently was elected to the board of directors for the International Lyme and Associate Disease Society. She's a member of the U.S. CFS Clinical Coalition, the American Academy of Ozonotherapy, and ISHWISH, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. She's an accomplished international speaker, writer, and leader, and has 8 peer-reviewed articles in the medical literature. Her latest endeavor is co-hosting a new podcast, Mast Cell Matters. So let's get at it with Dr. Tanya Dempsey. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. You heard in my introduction, it's going to be very amazing talk about a condition that's not talked about enough, but for those of us in this field that see a lot of various conditions, we see a lot of it. So welcome, Dr. Tanya Dempsey.
Thanks so much for having me. I can't wait to dive right in.
Let's dive right in.
Yeah.
You're just so knowledgeable on all of this stuff. So first of all, before we get into all of it, like, tell me kind of what brought you into the focus for today, because there's a lot that you focus on, but I want to just focus on mast cell activation and activation syndrome and how it kind of intersects with the stuff that we see as gynecologists, mm-hmm. sexual pain, endometriosis, and, perimenopause, menopause, all the hormonal shifts that happen at various times in our lives, these fluctuating levels of hormones and how it impacts patients. But tell our listeners how you kind of came into this world of MCAS.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting journey. You know, I'm basically an internist by training.
Yeah.
And so I was doing internal medicine for at least 12 years before I went on my own. And my interest really at the time was in women's health and polycystic mm-hmm. ovarian syndrome, PCOS. So as an internist, that was really my passion, because yeah. I really felt like those women were really not taken seriously. They were struggling with so many, you know, various symptoms, and like no one was really getting to the root cause. And so like I started thinking about it, and I started treating it, and I had some great success stories. And but you know, being in a multi-specialty practice where you have 7 minutes to see a patient, yeah. it becomes impossible, right?
Impossible.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, it's a longer story than that, but at some point, like in 2011, I said, I think yeah. I have it. That's it. I'm gonna go on my own. And I'm going to start, you know, I'm going to see patients the way they deserve to be seen. You know,
right.
Spend time with them, get a proper history, help them navigate the healthcare system. Yeah. And actually when I started, I sort of thought, no one's really going to come. So I'll just set up like a small little office and I don't really think that, you know, anyone's going to follow me, right? Yeah. So then like all the patients followed me and it grew really quickly. And then, you know, inevitably when you're spending time with patients and you're really trying to understand the connections between things, because that's the way my brain has always been.
Absolutely.
Inevitably you're going to start to discover things, right?
Yes.
That you never heard about.
Yes, yes.
And so somewhere around 2014, I have this patient who had this layer of symptoms following a sort of upper respiratory infection. And it was lasting months and I could not get her better. And I kept thinking, and she had a lot of hormonal issues. She had a lot of stuff. And I kept thinking like, I'm missing something. I don't know why she's not getting better. We've tried so many things. And you know, it was one of those fortuitous times I was on the internet or whatever, right? I was probably on PubMed. And I came across an article on mast cell activation syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I read the article, I'd never heard of it. And I thought, wow, you know, there's something about this that I wonder if this patient has this. And this was really early on. I mean, you know, there weren't that many articles in 2014 on mast cell activation syndrome. So I think I was really lucky. And the patient, actually, I spoke to the patient and I said, look, I think you have this thing. I don't really know much about it. Let me see if I could do more research. And she happened to have a family member who was in I think at the NIH. And he actually said, you know, there's this guy, Dr. Lawrence Afrin. Tell your doctor to reach out to him and he's gonna help. He's the world's expert in mast cell activation syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I said, all right, you know, I'll try. I'll reach out to him. I don't think he's really gonna talk to me, you know?
Yeah.
And so of course, you know, like, you know, 2 days later he's on the phone with me for like almost 2 hours lecturing me on mast cell activation syndrome and everything. And that was it. Like that was it. I just started to see it everywhere. I started to understand how much it was connected to so many of the things that a lot of my patients were struggling with.
Yes.
And then a few years later, I was doing a podcast and I said, I think like 90% at least of my patients have this. And he actually heard my podcast and he reached out to me and he said, wow, like kudos to you. He was at the University of Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
But he was very unhappy there because no one was taking this seriously. And he was really, really struggling.
Yeah.
So I said just very, very innocently in this email, you should come to New York because I think in New York, we're a little more open here and maybe we can, you know, work on this together or something. I said kind of like, again, not really thinking much about it. Next thing I know, he's like, can we talk? And 2 days later, he's on a plane to New York to meet me.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And within a month, he's here practicing with me.
That's amazing.
And he is the world's expert in mast cell activation syndrome. So he's been with me since 2017. So, you know, I've learned a lot from him. Mm-hmm. I've taught him a lot. Yeah. We've worked together on papers. And so, like, that's just it. So now it's just...
Now it's like we just... All of us are working together. You know what's so interesting is, you know, I speak about this a lot on the podcast because dealing with like vulval vaginal disease and menopause and all these things like take time. You have to listen to your patient. And before I had my own practice, I was really seeing, you know, in academics, seeing 30 patients a day. You don't have the time for, you know, this kind of thing. And I'm actually, I'm changing my practice model this summer to a concierge model just so that I can spend more time. But the more time you spend with patients, the more you can like really dig into their history and try to understand them. And I feel like that's like listening to patients is actually like such a small thing that we learned in medical school, but it's like the biggest thing to help us really help navigate their care, right? Like I think that as private doctors, you always think about the big academic centers doing all the big stuff. But I do find that like, you know, some of our smaller, like we're the ones like listening to the patients, getting the information, making connections together. Like it's just very interesting to think how the system is really meant to fail patients, especially, you know, female patients, I would say, like, you know, with all the issues that we have.
It's awful. And I don't know about you, but You know, I was always the one that wanted to spend time with patients because I always understood the connections. I can't tell you how many times my attendings would sit me down, and this is what they would say. Tanya, you're not going to succeed in medicine. You're just not. You cannot spend time with patients, right? Yeah. And I would like come home and be like, oh my God, I'm not going to succeed. You know, this is awful.
I know, right? It's so true, actually.
Ha-ha. All I want to say is ha, you know?
Now what?
It's like that's the very reason, right, that I'm successful is because I understood. You know, they would say to me, you have to concentrate on one problem. You know, if they have a headache, they have high blood pressure, they have joint pain, you pick one and you tell them to come back for the others. And I would say to them, but I think these things are all connected. I don't think it's one problem.
Right.
And how can you do that to the patient, right? It's just such a disservice.
Yeah. So true. And I think, you know, even like, as you know, I don't practice obstetrics anymore, but I just remember when I was in it, they're like, you can't spend that much time with your gynae patients, you know, like you got to get in and out and like, you know, you got to keep going and 40 patients and, you know, the OB patients need you. And, you know, they did at the time, but like, I'm just, you know, it's the mentality of how these, that's why there was an article that just came out. I just spoke to Kylie Moss about it, about medical gaslighting for women with vaginal disorders and JAMA yesterday. And it really went through like all the things that we hear all the time that women experience over and over again, like, you know, relax, have a glass of wine, like do all the things that, you know, because they don't have the time or the ability to really, you know, sit with the patients and kind of put on your detective hats and figure out what's going on. But that's amazing. I love that story. Well, let's talk about what is, for some people who are listening, maybe have, you know, I know some of them are mast cell patients, so they're listening, but there are people out there that are going to be like, what the hell is mast cell activation? So tell us, what the hell is mast cell activation syndrome?
Yeah, right. So, you know, the mast cells, just to give a little more background, right, mast cells are white blood cells. And, you know, as a lot of other white blood cells in our body, they're helping you, you know, fight infection, help to protect you from the environment. And the difference between mast cells, though, is that they're not really in the bloodstream like other white blood cells. They're actually in all your tissue and organs. And they're really in all these locations that are in contact with the environment. Again, they are first line of defense. They're part of what we call like the primordial, the primitive immune system. Right. So they're mast cells are in lots of animals, not just humans, right? They're really ancient immune cells. And they're really, like, really supposed to help us, right? They're really supposed to help fight stuff off, right? If something is bad, it sees a toxin, it sees an infection, it sees something that is different, it's going to react. And this is sort of the normal response of a mast cell. And the way that mast cells react is they manufacture different chemicals and they explode. And they release these chemicals. And some people might have heard of one of the chemicals that mast cells make is histamine. Right? So they're like here, you know, all over social media, people talk about histamine intolerance and high histamine foods and histamine. Histamine is really one of over 1,200 different chemicals that mast cells can make.
Yeah.
So while histamine is important, it's like a drop in the bucket.
Right.
There's really so much more to think about.
Yeah.
But all the chemicals that mast cells make are inflammatory in nature. So I think about, we know that allergy is often mast cell driven, right? So if you think about right now, is there's so much pollen in the air, at least here in New York. And so, you know, a mast cell response would be, okay, you see pollen, you're allergic to it. The mast cells in your nose, in your eyes, in your respiratory tract explode. They release histamine and these chemicals and causes swelling, and then that causes like the tissue swells, and then you sneeze, and then your eyes water, and then you can't breathe.
Yeah.
Right, so that's like a typical mast cell response to an allergen. But mast cells they're in the respiratory tract, they're in the GI tract, they're in all your connective tissue, in your ligaments, and in your tendons, in your joints. They're in the nervous system. They're in the GU system. They're in the bladder. They're in the uterus. They're in the vulva. They're in the vagina.
The vestibule. I talk about the vestibule a lot. So my listeners.
The vestibule. Wherever they are seeing a trigger, and it's not always allergic. Some of these triggers are not allergies, but the mast cell sees it, something is different, and it responds. Mm-hmm. So I want to distinguish, there are masks, so everyone has mast cells, and everyone's mast cells will release chemicals or degranulate at certain times of their life, okay? So you get COVID, you get the flu. Yeah. There's lots of circumstances when what would happen in a normal person who doesn't have mast cell activation syndrome, the mast cells explode, release the chemicals, try to fight the infection, recruit the rest of the immune system to come in and fight as well. And then the mast cells reset.
Right.
And then they just wait for the next attack.
Right.
In mast cell activation syndrome, those patients have, at a base level, leaking of the mast cell. The mast cell is like releasing these inflammatory chemicals, even when there isn't much going on. And then when the trigger comes, they go crazy, they degranulate, and then they don't reset.
Right.
So they come to a point where the threshold now is actually kind of lower, which means that it doesn't take as much to get them triggered again, and it becomes like a vicious cycle.
Sure, yeah.
And so the way I would think about mast cell activation syndrome is that it is a multi-system, mm-hmm. okay? So it usually involves multiple parts of the body, and it's an inflammatory condition, okay? The inflammation part of this is mm-hmm. pervasive. Mm-hmm. And the inflammation could be in a specific area of the body. It could be systemic. It often is systemic. And they're basically like three themes that we think about with mast cell activation syndrome, right? It's the inflammation, mm-hmm. plus minus allergic phenomena. And I say plus minus because there could be allergy, doesn't have to be allergy, could be allergic symptoms that are not allergy. And then plus minus, and we'll call it dystrophisms. And dystrophisms are like abnormal growth and development. So some MCAS patients have like lumps and bumps and cysts and little like lipomas or thyroid,
yeah.
thyroid cysts or ovarian cysts mm-hmm. or, right? So like things that are growing abnormally.
Right.
And that's because mast cells, when they're working well, are involved in growth and development. And we know that they're actually supposed to help us.
Mm-hmm.
But think of mast cells as like this dichotomy of they're good, we need them. There's a lot of good stuff that we cannot do without. But when they become dysfunctional mm-hmm. and they're not reacting appropriately, that's when they set people up for this, you know, kind of a storm of symptoms.
Well, right. And so for those listening, like, why is a gynecologist so interested? Well, you know, I do sexual medicine and I do menopause care. And so I find that, and we've all seen now this link, this what I want to have some sort of triad that you guys, we call it the triad yep. of mast cell and POTS and hypermobile disorders, right? So can we talk a little bit about that and how it's related? Well, actually, before you talk about that, what's the best way to diagnose mast cell activation syndrome?
So number one is the clinical picture. And really getting a very, very good history. You know, I sometimes take 3 hours to take a history on a patient. You know, it's about really understanding. First, you really need to understand the health of their mother when they were pregnant with them. That sets up the immune system. That sets up a lot of things on how the mast cells work from a very early age, whether there was trauma, whether the mother was malnourished, whether the mother was, you know, some people don't know that part of the history, but I take the history all the way from the health of the mother. And then through the course of their life, are there events that change things? Do they remember a specific episode where things changed enough that they know that, you know, they were not the same? You know, often people can remember, you know, oh, I was in Costa Rica and I got diarrhea and after that I never recovered.
Yes. It's all a sentinel event, right?
Right. That's right.
Almost.
That's right.
Yeah.
So first that history is really important, and that gives us a little bit of a clue. Okay, this is a patient who could have mast cell activation syndrome. We try to do testing. You know, in my office, we have it set up. We have a refrigerated centrifuge. A lot of the things that we test for are the mediators that the mast cells release, these chemicals. These chemicals tend to be, we call it thermolabile. So they're heat sensitive. So we use a refrigerated centrifuge when we're spinning blood or whatever, because we want to make sure that everything stays cold. We have them collect urine. The urine has to stay cold. And we're trying to measure and trying to find these chemicals that mast cells release. And that suggests if we find these chemicals that the mast cells are activated, that gives us a clue.
Right.
We can do biopsy samples. There are lots of different ways. It's complicated, right? And I would say there are some people who are going to be able to go through the formal testing. And there are some people who, just based on their symptoms, we're going to have to start treating, right? So it's a little bit complicated. I wish there was a better way to diagnose. Right. But right now, that's kind of what we do.
Okay. And so the link, when do you think this was sort of, it was just observationally people noticed? I mean, I think I started noticing in my office a few years ago, and then I was like, oh, there's stuff in the literature on it. You know, is that, because I know you're part of the mast cell, what's it called? The group of people that get together for.
There is, right. We have a mast cell group, and actually we just formed a nonprofit organization.
Oh, wonderful.
This is hot off the press.
Yes.
Hot off the press. Like, literally just happened. We're waiting for our formal 501c3 designation. But the organization is ISMCAS, is MCAS, International Society for Mast Cell Activation Syndrome.
Oh, wonderful.
And we're really excited. So there's more to come on that. Okay. That's brand new.
Right.
So yes, we have a group of people who, you know, are really interested in understanding the mast cell, researching, trying to provide more support for patients, right? So that's what we're trying to do.
Oh, I was talking about how the links that we've associated with some of these
other
you know, conditions and how they relate.
Yeah, so there are lots of conditions, right? So there's the triad that you mentioned, there needs to be more research, and I'll be honest, and the research in the literature has been a little bit inconclusive, but I can tell you anecdotally, it's not inconclusive. But that triad of mast cell activation syndrome, hypermobility syndrome, or EDS, and POTS seems pretty strong. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, you know, it's interesting. If you look at it from a hypermobility specialist, they may say something different. If you look at it from a POTS specialist, they may say something different.
Yeah.
My lens is the mast cell. So I think the mast cell is the driver for the most part. That the mast cells are, there's tons of mast cells in the connective tissue. They release a number of chemicals, enzymes that break down connective tissue, like elastase. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the mast cells activating in the connective tissue is damaging them, so to speak, making them maybe weaker or stretchier or whatever we see with hypermobility. And from the POTS perspective, you know, sort of the same thing. You have lots of mast cells in the vasculature, in the nervous system. And so probably there is some interaction there causing patients to have more postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or even just more generally dysautonomia.
Right.
So we know those are linked.
Yeah.
But what we now understand is that there are lots of other conditions that seem to be linked. I have this graphic that I use a lot when I lecture, and it's like 11 or 12 different things now that are all connected. Definitely endocrine disorders, insulin resistance, polycystic ovarian syndrome. I can tell you is very, very closely linked. I have yet to find a PCOS patient who does not have mast cell activation syndrome. That's how strong that link is.
Do you think it's the media, because it's the inflammation that's caused, probably leading to insulin resistance, which then is causing all the PCOS symptoms, right?
Correct. And I think that the insulin resistance then also feeds back and makes the mast cell activation syndrome worse, and it becomes a vicious cycle.
Gotcha. Okay. All right.
Which is why sometimes it's harder to treat than you would think.
Yeah.
Right? For some patients, you treat their insulin resistance, you put them on metformin, you do all this stuff, and like, yet it's not really moving the needle. And so that's where you say, oh, I think I have to focus more on the mast cell piece of this, because there's something I have to stop this inflammatory cycle. So hormones are a big piece of the puzzle for a lot of patients.
Yeah.
And we certainly know that when you get a history, the times in a woman's life where mast cell activation syndrome is most likely to present would be puberty.
Yeah. Postpartum.
Right. Postpartum. Mm-hmm. Perimenopause.
Yeah.
Like fall, classic.
Classic.
You know?
Roller coasters or lack of hormones.
Totally.
Or increase of hormones, or, you know, the That's interesting because I do find that in my perimenopausal patients with MCAS that it's very hard to, well, perimenopause is like a roller coaster for everyone. And I feel like right. if you throw in the mast cell stuff, like it's a little bit harder to tweak their symptoms. Like the estrogen may seem too much too soon, or, you know, the progesterone is better than you thought. Like, so where, how do you kind of approach that? And what are your thoughts around sort of like estrogen, yeah. progesterone, how they relate?
I think the key is this, that mast cells are really, they're geared towards measuring changes. Okay. So it's not always the actual thing that's the problem, like the actual estrogen or the actual hormone. It's the delta, shift in
the delta,
it.
Yeah.
The delta.
Yeah.
The same with barometric pressure, your change in weather, right? So it's these things that the mast cell is reading. And so beyond that, we know that estrogen tends to be a little bit more activating. We know that the mast cell has receptors on their surface, over 300 different receptors.
Mm-hmm.
We know there are estrogen, we know there's progesterone receptors and testosterone receptors and thyroid receptors and insulin receptors, and the list goes on. So we know that the hormones can bind to the mast cell, and some studies, particularly done in mice and rats, show that the estrogen seems to be a little more activating and the progesterone seems to be more stabilizing, but it's not always for the individual patient that clear, right?
Yes.
And so we're not mice and we're not, you know, rats. So we, you know, we
right,
have
exactly.
to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. It's so nuanced, actually.
It's so new. It's so nuanced.
Yeah.
So I have patients, MCAS patients, who do very well with estrogen, even though you would think that it would be more activating for them. But in the perimenopausal or menopausal stage, you know, steady state estrogen might be okay for them because it's not fluctuating, right?
In the postmenopause, yeah.
But progesterone, you would think, well, progesterone is stabilizing, right? So you're combining it with the estrogen, right? Theoretically, that should be good for them. And then I have those patients who cannot tolerate progesterone in any form. You know, we've tried it, oral, topical,
yeah.
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, progesterone for that, for their mast cells is not right, right? And so then becomes, if they have a uterus, right, and we're trying to give them estrogen, we have to sort of figure out how to balance it. So it's not easy. I think there are different ways to do it. You know, sometimes it's about, you know, they have to take progesterone, but like we don't have to do it as often,
right.
if they're on lower dose estrogen, right? We have, yeah, you probably know more about this than me, but I think there are like tricks to the trade to get, you know, to get patients and women to not suffer.
Yeah.
But all about like trying to find the right key.
And I think we see that like progesterone sensitivity a lot in patients who have PMDD, that premenstrual
yeah.
dysphoric disorder. So one of the things that I like to do is really like if they have a progesterone sensitivity, they can't tolerate any progesterone, but they're doing well on the estrogen, is use the FDA approved Duave, which is like oral Premarin, but benzodoxifene, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator. So they get the uterine protection because they're blocking the estrogen at the uterus, but and they're not getting actually any stimulation of their breast. So they like that, especially if they have breast cancer history or whatever in their family.
Yeah, no, it's a great, yeah, it's a very, very interesting product, yeah. Absolutely.
And so do you think that if you add, like, because, you know, if for some of these patients, we know insulin resistance starts in perimenopause for so many people when you have these fluctuating
yep.
levels, do you think the metformin piece, like, when can be like a different factor that might be helpful because it promotes anti-inflammatory factors or helps with that insulin?
I love metformin. I mean, I've been using metformin in my patients since I started practicing, and since, you know, my interest in PCOS from very early on, I was using metformin. So I think for a lot of women, absolutely, metformin was always my go-to. You know, now we have these GLP-1
yeah.
agonists,
yes.
and I have to talk about it a little bit. We have a paper that we're about to submit for publication. We have it's a 50-patient case series.
Okay.
On the use of GLP-1s in mast cell activation syndrome.
Oh, let's hear it. I want to hear this.
So it'll be published soon. I can't say too much, but what I can say is that, you know, our data is pretty compelling. Like it's really like mind blowing. And I just you know, I don't want to generalize. It's definitely not the right drug for everyone. And I certainly have patients who will not tolerate it or shouldn't take it. So yeah. I want to say that just because I think people hear this and they say, oh, you know, give me Ozempic right. or Mounjaro. But at microdosing, sometimes you can avoid some of these really bad side effects. Mm-hmm. And mast cells have GLP-1 receptors.
Yes.
They have GIP receptors, which are the two agonists that are in, like, tirzepatide or Mounjaro.
Right.
And so they look like they can stabilize mast cells. And they have some anti-inflammatory properties as well. Obviously, also help with insulin resistance. So, right. you know, I still have the patients where I think metformin is going to be a better choice for them. I have patients. Yeah. I actually have patients who are on both. You know, some of them, let's say, have been on metformin for some time because I've been treating them. I have patients I've been treating for 15, 20 years, even before my own practice. They followed me. So they have PCOS. I have them on metformin. They get to the perimenopausal phase where the metformin is not doing enough anymore for them. Then we're layering on maybe a little GLP-1. I mean, obviously, we're doing other things as well.
Yeah.
But it's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is a fascinating drug. I mean, even in the world of sexual medicine, I think we're seeing so many potential changes and how the GLPs work in your brain and how it affects your dopamine pathways
Correct.
And all the things.
Correct.
Like, it's a very interesting drug, actually. And I think it has some compelling evidence and potential uses in a lot of things. So it's an exciting time for so many.
It's exciting. I mean, again, it's not right for everyone. I'm hopeful that there will be better formulations with time that maybe will have less side effects. There are just going to be patients who are just not able to tolerate even at the micro dosing level.
Sure.
And some of those patients are disappointed, you know, and I feel bad. I'm like, okay, well, let's wait and see if we've, you know, can find something else.
Yeah. Tell me, what do you think of when you come, when we talk about PCOS and MCAS, like, you know, I've always sort of considered PCOS to be something you're genetically predisposed to and that, you know, you likely have, although it doesn't fit the criteria for some patients, right? Some patients have no significant metabolic dysfunction in their family. And so, you know, you think about the ones that are like thinner and they don't have all the typical phenotypes.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that mast cell is the missing piece, because sometimes I'm like, well, there's not that much metabolic dysfunction in their family and they don't fit the, you know, but they have all the symptoms that are consistent with the PCOS diagnosis. I mean, do you think that people have a hereditary predisposition to MCAS? Is that what you think it is? Or do you think they're exposed to, like, you know, with some of the theories around vestibulodynia and congenital neuroproliferative, like, are they exposed to something at like a really young age in the diaper region and that's caused mast cells to become aberrantly active? Or is it because they have this genetic predisposition and therefore they don't tolerate the things that normally, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so nuanced.
Yeah.
Or complicated.
Oh, no, for sure. So the way I think about it is that I think there is some kind of genetic vulnerability. Like, we're never going to find the gene. There's no gene for mast cell activation syndrome, but I think it's a vulnerability.
Yeah.
And then because very frequently you will see other family members who have some symptoms. They may not be as severe, but they have some, you know, flavor of it, you know, so you know that there's something in the family. But I do believe that it is exposures over time that bring it out. So I agree with you. I think that's why I take the history from birth or actually from the pregnancy of the mother or even before the mother got pregnant, because exposures in the mother to things like petrochemicals, pesticides, you know, there are all these different environmental factors that may already predispose them very early on. You know, so they have, the mother has a toxic load, and then the baby is being exposed to these toxins. Then they're born, and then maybe there's an additional exposure from something, whether it's a diaper, whether it's, you know, the baby powder with talc in it or whatever else, you know.
Right.
And then, you know, I think, you know, what I love is I have a colleague at UT San Antonio whose life's work, her name is Dr. Claudia Miller. Her life's work is in a condition known as TILT, toxicant-induced loss of tolerance. And essentially it's chemical intolerance, okay, or chemical sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And she has this great graphic of an iceberg. And so what she says is that, you know, there's a susceptible person, right? They're like low down on this iceberg, and they get some kind of exposure to something. Then they become the sensitive person. And they don't even realize they're more sensitive. But then there's some low-level exposures to various things until they, like, break through the water. Right now, they're the iceberg is out. And now they are the sick patient.
Yeah.
And for many years in her career, like, she didn't understand the mechanism of that. She could explain tilt. She could find the things that were causing this condition tilt, but she didn't know the mechanism. And then she came across some of Dr. Afrin's work. She came across some of my work, some of our papers. And so we started collaborating with her, mm-hmm. and we did a study together. And basically it showed that the root cause of this chemical intolerance was mast cell activation syndrome. And so now when I show that, like, iceberg, when I use that for my lectures, basically it's explaining the mast cells. The mast cells get primed.
Yeah.
Then they get more exposure. And then, boom, they're out. So when you think about congenital neuroproliferative vestibulodynia, I think that absolutely you're right. You know, maybe there's a susceptibility that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Right? We can't identify that because there's no, like, gene that causes it. But then there's an exposure, and then their mast cells start to proliferate along with the nerves, right? And so I think that that's a very common problem that I think that explains why people are having that. And then if we go back to PCOS, I think that a lot of these patients with PCOS, if you really look at their history and get that history, many of them will say, yeah, I grew up, I was a baby in a moldy apartment or moldy home. So they had some kind of exposure to toxins there. They had some kind of trauma. They had, you know, these are the ones I'm talking about that maybe don't have a family history of PCOS, sure. Right? There's something else that's then bringing out this,
right,
this inflammatory condition.
Interesting. Yeah, that's so interesting. Do you get a sense of, I mean, what the prevalence of something like MCAS is?
Yeah. There's one study, and I really wish that somebody else would do more studies on it, but there was a study done in Germany. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thought is that the German population is probably similar to the U.S. population. And they estimated that 17% of their population have MCAS. Yeah. Now, I would say that study was from 2017. And I would say that there does seem to be a rise in MCAS post-COVID vaccine. I think we're just seeing a lot more of it. So I would venture to guess without, you know, sort of off the record, that we're probably 20%, if not more. Mm. And that's, you know, one in five people have some feature of MCAS.
Aberrant selectivity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because I think it's so, because you're right, because of the predominance of where mast cells are and how they impact, like, so many systems, that it'd be really hard to, you know, say that some of these systems aren't affected. And it's interesting that some systems are affected and some won't, right? Like, so I have some patients with, I know they have neuroproliferative vestibulodynia that was caused by some sort of inflammatory reaction to, you know, high dose, you know, over the counter
Sulfonazole
or something, one of the but they, you know, they might have had that reaction, but they don't have any other, like, they don't have allergy, you know, they don't have the typical allergic stuff. You know, they don't have the other stuff. And so it's interesting as to whether or not, you know, they would respond well to some of these medications. Yeah. Let's talk about treatment, actually. Yeah. Like, what do you do for some of these patients with cell activation?
So, you know, the number one, step one thing that we need to think about is eliminating triggers. So if there are things that are continually making the mast cells, you know, get activated, you really do have to kind of start there. And that's where you really work with the patient to understand, you know, is there a medication they're taking that has some kind of filler in it that is irritating the mast cell? Are they living in mold? Do they have some kind of chronic infection? Are they using personal care products that are, you know, fragrance that have fragrances? You know, what is the actual trigger, right? And sort of work on that.
Yeah.
And then for treatment, it's all about stabilizing the mast cell and blocking the effects of the chemicals that the mast cells make. So we often try antihistamines, you know, with the thought that maybe histamine is one of the chemicals that they're releasing. So it could be natural antihistamines. It could be, you know, pharmaceutical. Over the counter, we have 4 antihistamines that are non-sedating, and then Claritin, Zyrtec, Allegra, Zizol, Benadryl, which is sedating, but can be very helpful for some people. We have, those are H1 blockers. There are a few actually that are prescription. There are a few that we get from Canada that we can't get here. We have H2 blockers like cimetidine or Tagamet or famotidine. Sometimes combining those together can be very helpful. If histamine's not their problem, then a lot of times these antihistamines won't help. So we have a long list of various compounds, again, both natural and pharmacologic, that are designed to address the dysfunctional mast cell at some level. Sometimes it is literally like we know it's binding to the mast cell and trying to send it a signal like stop, like a GLP-1. Sometimes it's mechanisms that we don't really fully even understand, like low-dose naltrexone.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's, you know, drugs with combination effects, like they have some antihistamine effect, but then they also do something to stabilize the mast cell, like ketotifen. So, and again, most of the things we're using are oral, could be IV, theoretically, like Benadryl or Zyrtec. But, you know, in the case of things like neuroproliferative vestibulodynia, we're looking at, you know, as part of this sort of consortia where we're looking at, you know, are there mast cell targeted therapies that can be applied topically, potentially?
Yeah. I know ketotifen was one of the potential ones, right?
Which showed some promise, you know, some preliminary data did show some promise.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, we did publish a paper in 2018 that looked at various conditions like dyspareunia. It was dyspareunia, menorrhagia. It was like a few different
endometriosis. Was it part of that?
Yeah, I think there was endometriosis and there was one more condition. And we used, it was a case series, and we used various modalities to treat. Sometimes we used suppositories of various mast cell targeted therapies. Sometimes we used douching. Sometimes we used oral preparations, and my case was a woman with PCOS and menorrhagia who took Claritin and Pepcid and like stopped her menorrhagia. It was like that she couldn't stop for months and months and months.
Oh wow!
So sometimes it's at, like a simple intervention like that, and so we published on that. So I do think that there are lots of different ways you can try to calm down the mast cell.
Yeah, some of us just trial and error, right? Because we don't know which ones they will respond to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is an emerging field, and I think, you know, it'll continue to evolve. And so, you know, we will keep asking the questions and doing the research. Well, what kind of advice would you give someone that's kind of suffering with what they think is mast cell activation and where to find the help they need?
Yeah. So, you know, there are thankfully a lot of resources now, you know, even the stuff that I put out there, you know, on social media, blog posts, I try to just keep, you know, the education going. And so, but there are a lot of my colleagues who are also sort of doing the same thing. So I feel like now is a better time than ever, right, to at least get some information to read about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue we have is just finding practitioners who are willing to treat.
Right.
And what I say is this, you don't need a mast cell specialist. Well, you might need a mast cell specialist.
Right.
But what you really need is a practitioner who's willing to listen and willing to learn. Because there are many of us who are willing to teach as long as that person is open. So if you have somebody who doesn't know about mast cell activation syndrome, but is interested in learning and interested in helping you as a patient get better, right? There are lots of us who will talk to and train those practitioners to help their patients. So I think it's getting better. Our goal is to educate more and more people so that they can treat more patients. There are not enough of us out there clearly doing this work. But like I said, I think that there's a lot of information, and so unfortunately, it falls on the patient to advocate for themselves.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think that's really important when it comes to any of the stuff that we talk about. Is at the end of the day, it's like it's your health, and you have to actually get to the resources and find the best thing that you can do for yourself. Because no one's going to save you, unfortunately. At the end of the day, it really is our own. We have to advocate for ourselves and our own health and all the things. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you, Tanya. I really appreciate you being on today. I know, this is great. There's so much we could talk about. We could go on forever.
Oh, we could talk for hours.
Yeah. So I'll have to have you back on, but I appreciate you coming in to give us some of the 101 basics. And
yeah, of course.
Your research when it's published. So I'll look out for it on social.
Yeah, absolutely.
In touch with what's happening with Ishwish. But thank you once again. Thanks for listening, everyone. My name is Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Join me for the next episode.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.